From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I talked to avant-garde composer and musician John Zorn. His latest album, The Big Gundown, is inspired by the spaghetti western film scores of Ennio Morricone. Also today, I talk with John and Rosemary Harbison. John Harbison won this year's Pulitzer Prize for Music. He's written many compositions for his wife, Rosemary, the violinist featured on his new album. Jazz critic Francis Davis reviews In All Languages, the new album by Ornette Coleman, and TV critic David Bianculli looks at the latest talk show starring the ultimate talk show host, Max Headroom. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is composer and musician John Zorn. He's one of the leading figures in improvised music. Unlike jazz, Zorn's improvisations do not follow pre-established melodic lines and chord changes. The patterns it does follow are more like the rules that govern games. In fact, many of Zorn's compositions have names like archery and pool and highlight. In the past few years, Zorn shifted the direction of his music from improvisation to composition and interpretation. This began when he was asked to contribute his arrangements to anthologies of compositions by Thelonious Monk and Kurt Weill. Last year, Zorn's tribute to the Italian film composer Ennio Morricone earned wide critical acclaim. Morricone is best known for his scores for the films The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and Once Upon a Time in America. Zorn, who is classically trained, has said of his generation that they've been exposed to a wider variety of music than any other generation, and he himself is well-versed in jazz, pop, movie scores, and TV themes. John Zorn's forthcoming album features a tribute to Mickey Spillane, the detective writer. Let's listen to the opening of it. An excerpt of a tribute to Mickey Spillane composed by my guest John Zorn, who's featured on saxophone on that recording. John, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hi.
I think a lot of people who know you as a composer of improvised music are going to be surprised that you're attributing Mickey Spillane. What's the idea in back of the music?
Well, I composed this piece as a tribute to him because I think he stands for a lot more than just detective novels. I think he sums up a whole era in American history. The tough detective is almost an icon in American history. So I chose Spillane, even his name, Spillane. I mean, everybody knows who Spillane is pretty much. And when they hear the name Spillane, they think of, you know, Mike Hammer, hard-boiled detective, the city, things like that. And I grew up in the city all my life, and the city is very important to me. It's like kind of a weird mix of genres. It's weird mix of peoples and cultures, of languages, and I try to express that somehow in the music with the Spillane piece in particular. Each section of the piece, there's about 65 sections, and each section somehow relates very directly to to an aspect of Spillane's work, either maybe there may be a portrait of one of his characters or a scene that's depicted in one of the stories. I kind of make a soundtrack to it, or I summarize one of the narratives of one of his books in a short little 20-second segment.
It makes you yearn for the days when all detective movies and detective TV shows had jazz scores.
Yeah.
Because they've all switched to funk for the most part.
There's a lot of funk.
Not that I object to that, but
funk
there were some
okay.
great jazz scores.
Yeah, I think something like Spillane, like when the Eye of the Jury movie came out, how many years ago was it? 5 years ago? They did a remake of that story. The score was a jazz score, but it didn't have the same sleaziness that 50s jazz really had. It wasn't dirty.
There are references to the Route 66 theme in your Spillane piece, and I think a little homage to Bernard Herrmann's theme for Taxi Driver. You've really listened to so much music, and I am struck by that quote that I mentioned when I was introducing you about how you think you and your generation have been introduced to a wider variety of music than any generation before.
Oh, that's really true. And the other musicians who work in New York and the Lower East Side, which is where I live and have lived for a long, long time, people like Elliot Sharp, Wayne Horvitz, Tim Byrne, Bill Frisell, all of these musicians grew up in the same era that I did, born in the 50s, really became conscious people in the 60s. And at that time, the recording industry was exploding. And the idea of the album as a full length 20 minutes on a side had really come into its own, from LPs to 10 inches, from 78s to 10 inches, and then into the LP. The 60s was really an era where you could buy music from almost any country in the world. You could get Balinese music, you could get African music. Movie soundtracks became more and more available on record, and they were not so available in the 50s. It became really the modern genre of music, a 20th century, a new discovery for the 20th century, film and TV music as a genre. And we were exposed to all of this kind of music, and as growing musicians, we voraciously ate it all and bought as much as we could afford and listened to as much as we could. And radio stations really helped in that too, just being able to listen to the radio. Passing through the dials in New York, you get Latin stations, you get there's Chinese stations, there's Japanese radio.
You first became known for your improvised music, for a very avant-garde form of improvisation, which doesn't improvise on the theme or the chord changes the way we're used to improvisation in jazz. And I'd like to talk with you about how you got from that kind of music, which basically turned its back on composition as we know it, to returning to a form of composition, but taking with it a lot that you learned from your improvisations. Let's start with the kind of improvisation that you first became known for. Would you describe some of the rules that governed the way the music was played?
Well, there's really two things you're speaking about here. One is the actual improvisations that I worked with. And my personal language in improvising for many, many years was using the saxophone and supplementing it with other reed instruments, not necessarily clarinet and bass clarinet, but also smaller things that used a reed, like a duck call or any different kinds of animal calls and bird calls that used a reed. And these things were almost like small mouthpieces. And to me, the sound fitted into the sound of a reed instrument, the saxophone. And for many years, I actually sat there and played duck calls with other musicians who played guitar and percussion, things like that, to create. It was more like a workshop atmosphere. There were no rules. There were no rules in that situation. You got together with someone and you improvised with them, and whatever happened was what happened. And I still do that, but I see it very much now as a workshop, learning from other musicians, exchanging ideas. Kind of like the way they write about the 1940s jazz scene in Kansas City and New York in the early 50s, the jam sessions and chili house sessions where the early bop musicians would get together after hours with the swing cats and play and learn and study. This was kind of what I feel a lot of people from my generation did in the early 70s. We used improvisation because, for me personally, I was dissatisfied with the kind of music that the classic world had been producing at the time. It seemed very dry, overly intellectual. It didn't have a strong emotional impact. And I thought that there was a way of mixing the two, getting a music that was, you know, very emotional, but at the same time, very, very advanced in terms of the way it was put together. And some players that I was attracted to in the early 70s, like Anthony Braxton, Leo Smith, Roscoe Mitchell, Cecil Taylor, I think were moving in that direction as well, trying to mix the two, find a balance between the mind and the heart in a certain way. I listened to that music a lot, and also the music of improvisers like Derek Bailey, Han Benink, Evan Parker, who were working in Europe at the time, and were also trying to pull away from the dry academic world and use improvisation. And I think what happened was, after a period of years, I began to hear things again that were not happening in just purely improvised situations. I'd improvise with someone and then say to myself, well, I wish that this could happen. So then I'd try to find a situation where it could happen.
So you'd set up...
I'd set up game structures.
Game structures.
And then then I went into my period of writing games.
What's an example of a game structure that you gave musicians?
Well, they're kind of complicated, but simply it could be seen as, let's say, a trading system. I play a little bit, and then you play. And then I play, and then you play. Back and forth, like tossing a ball back and forth. Or giving a downbeat, and when that downbeat happens, say, people who are playing must stop, and people who aren't playing may come in if they wish. But there are many, many, many different games like that that I structure in a kind of set of rules.
We've heard your tribute to Mickey Spillane. We've heard a small part of it. I want to play music that represents a different side of you, something the kind of improvised music that we're talking about now. We're going to play the opening from your album, Cobra.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to say anything about how this music was performed?
Yeah. Like I said, it's a set of rules, and the score is on one sheet of paper. Everybody gets the same sheet, and I don't talk about sound at all, because everybody has developed their own personal language through improvising for many years. There's sounds that you can get on the guitar that you can't write down. So I moved away from writing those sounds or trying to write them down graphically or whatever. And I just talked about the relationship of the players. So in this particular instant, we went into the studio and one day. We recorded about 1 hour of music using this score. And... this is what happened that day.
Okay, this is an excerpt of Cobra, composed by John Zorn. That's an example of John Zorn's improvised music from his album Cobra. And now you've been really moving away from that. Did you find yourself being dissatisfied with the organized randomness of that kind of music?
No, I still compose pieces like this for the people that I work with, and I find them very successful in live situations. They don't always come off on record. I think there's a big difference between live music and recorded music. The pieces like Spillane and the arrangements like I did for the Big Gun Down and the Kurt Weill piece are really pieces meant to be done in the studio, to be listened to on record or on CD at home.
Well, in a minute, I want to play an excerpt of the Big Gun Down, which ended up on a lot of jazz critics' 10 best lists and was written up in Time magazine and really made quite a splash. My guest is composer and musician John Zorn, and we'll talk some more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Composer and musician John Zorn is my guest, who's one of the leading figures in improvised music and is now doing composition and interpretation as well. I want to, before we talk some more about your life, I want to play an excerpt of The Big Gun Down, which is really invigorating music. There's so many different sides of your music to show. And I want to play The Battle of Algiers from your album The Big Gun Down, which is your tribute to Ennio Morricone, the Italian film score composer who did The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly and Once Upon a Time in America. Before we hear this, how did you get excited by his music?
I've been listening to his music since I first saw Fistful of Dollars back in the early 60s. And even as a kid, I was really attracted and I guess heavily influenced by his use of sound, the way he put different instruments together, his orchestration, really. And that's something that's really fascinated me all my life. Orchestration is one of my great loves. And in this record, my arranging skills, I think, are really put to the test because Morricone is such a genius with the orchestra and using jew's harp and guitar. And he was really a pioneer with the electric chimes, with the electric guitar, and bringing it into soundtrack music.
And as we'll hear, you've taken something close to his original orchestration, I think, but you've added things.
Well, what I've done actually is I strayed away from his original orchestration on each piece, but the record as a whole stays within his musical language. So you could say that maybe if on the original piece, Battle of Algiers, there was actually a brass section working, instead of giving that music, which I transcribed off the original record, to a brass section, I gave it to, say, someone playing turntables. And if maybe there was something that was an oboe solo at one section, maybe I gave that to someone who was whistling. So the whistling and the oboe and the jew's harp and the guitar are all elements of his world. I just kind of shuffled them around a little bit and then mixed in some of my own world in there, too.
Okay, this is John Zorn's interpretation of an orchestration of Ennio Morricone's The Battle of Algiers. the opening of John Zorn's arrangement of Ennio Morricone's The Battle of Algiers. I think that's very stirring. That's one of the things I love about film scores, is that they have more epic sweep than most music has anymore.
Mm.
They're big.
Yeah, they're really big. But, I mean, a lot of the soundtracks are coming, the people who write soundtracks are coming from a kind of 19th century head. All that music has that same kind of epic sweep, and these are frustrated composers in many cases who wish that they were born in the 19th century and have found a home in the soundtrack world. People like Miklos Rocha and Korngold are a few examples of that, and they're geniuses and they're wonderful musicians, and they've created a really great body of work.
I'm interested in your background. How did someone who was so obviously listening to pop and to watching television, listening to the radio, how did you end up in classical music?
Well, I didn't listen to pop that much, to tell you the truth.
When you were young?
When I was young, I was really into organ music.
Really?
Bach, believe it or not, a weird kid. I listened to The Doors, but I got into The Doors because I had an organ in it. I guess before that, you know, I'd been listening to straight-ahead classical stuff since I was small. I don't know why. I mean, you get attracted to different things. There was a friend of mine in school who was really interested in that, and maybe he kind of got me into it or something.
So you were playing what when you were in classical? Not saxophone, I'm sure.
No, I played piano first, and I played guitar in the Beatles period. Kind of played guitar a little while, and then I played flute and clarinet, and when I went to school, I studied a little bit of all the instruments because I was studying composition. They wanted you to get a grasp of all the instruments, so I learned trombone and tuba and string instruments and stuff. But I didn't finally focus on the saxophone until I was about 20 years old.
Did you go to a conservatory?
I went out to St. Louis to go to school for a year and a half, a small college called Webster College. There was a very active jazz music scene at the time. The AACM was working and the black arts group BAG was working, and I had been attracted to that music because it had used improvisation and had a lot of guts to it, and I was really again attracted to that emotional impact. So I went out there for a little while and dropped out after a year and a half.
Were you very rebellious when you were in music school?
I think I was very rebellious all my life.
When you're talking about improvisational music and avant-garde music, the question sometimes comes up about ideas versus the music itself. Sometimes the ideas are really interesting to talk about or think about, but the music isn't always as interesting as the ideas themselves are. And I wonder if you ever found that to be true with some of the composers who you were studying or listening to.
Well, for me, I was always interested in making music, and the ideas were always secondary. Had an idea that resulted in a good musical product, and it was a good idea. I know that you're talking about John Cage right now, because we were talking before, and you said that you felt that you liked his philosophical ideas and weren't so happy with his music. I'm not sure exactly how I feel about his philosophical ideas. To tell you the truth, I like a lot of his early music, and when he got into his Zen period, I don't like his writing. And although he did do a lot for stretching musical boundaries in terms of looking for different sounds, I don't think he was the only person who was doing that. Harry Partch was working along those lines. Later, Maurizio Kagel, Stockhausen, people who worked with tape. Someone like Carl Stallings, who wrote music for Warner Brothers cartoons in the 40s, to me, is much more on the forefront of American activity than John Cage was in the 40s. I think that's still some of the most avant-garde music America has produced. People like Charles Ives. There's a real history of maverick composers who were looking for new sounds. Cage is one of those people, and I think his name is overused. I don't find that he's my grandfather. And every year when they do another tribute to him, it just gets tiresome to me.
I think a lot of people who follow the avant-garde, some of the people who follow the avant-garde, are into adventurousness and renegadism as much as they are into the music itself that's being played. And I wonder if you've ever found that true of your followers, that some of them are maybe into the excitement of breaking rules more than
the music itself. People often say that, you know, out for out's sake, avant-garde for avant-garde's sake, Frankly, I've never met anybody like that.
Really?
Never. I don't know what people are talking about when they're saying that. I think it's fear. I think they're coming from fear of new things, and they're judging someone. Oh, well, you're doing something that's so weird. You're just doing it 'cause it's weird. You're not really trying to make any musical statement. I don't think that's a valid. I don't think you can judge someone that way. If someone wants to make something that's different, and they find, you know, that from within them there's, you know, something that's making them do this, and that's fine. And everyone has different motivations.
It's very difficult for composers to make a living composing, and I guess I'm interested in how you decided to stick it out and be brave about it and not turn your back on composition and try to make it as a composer. It's so hard to do, especially when you don't have a teaching position.
Yeah, well, I've really avoided that whole school scene and the teaching scene, which I think is the death of many great composers. Someone who ends up in an institutional atmosphere, and institutional is a very good word because we're not just talking about the food, we're talking about the air that they breathe there and the people that they hang out with. It's very stifling, and I find it very difficult, you know, to live there. I never turned my back on composition, ever. I was brought up as a composer. When I worked as an improviser, I found it was more kind of taking in new information, working with people of my own peer group who were, you know, also using instruments. I moved to the saxophone so that I could play with different people, because playing was so important at that time in the 70s, exchanging ideas that way. I never turned my back on composition, and even when I was improvising, I think with a compositional head. When I improvise even today, I think as a composer, and I move the music as a composer would try to move it. I don't think I'm a virtuoso on my instrument. I'm not really. I'm a composer who plays, and there's a large tradition of that as well, into Chopin, Bach, and Mozart were all performers as well. As far as making a living as a composer, it's very difficult, and I don't do that. I don't make a living as a composer. I make a living as a performer. When I go to perform my music in Europe, I get paid. When I write music, I do it for my ensemble and nobody pays me. Getting commissions is a very, very tricky political maneuver. And what we're really talking about now is the academic world. The academic world, and that's something that maybe you'll be able to talk about with John Harbison when he comes here. He's a member of that world, and I'm not. I'm on the outskirt of it. Getting commissions in that world is a matter of paying dues in that world, and I haven't really done that.
And you probably won't. It sounds like you don't plan on being a part of it.
Well, you'll be surprised. I'm beginning to move, you know, really? Into those circles. I'm beginning to make friends in those circles. And you have to make friends. You have to, you know, be in that scene, be visible for years and years before you're accepted. And I'm beginning to inch my way in, but I'm doing it from the back door.
John Zorn, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us today. And John Zorn has been my guest. He's a composer and musician, one of the leaders in improvised music. And his music also now is heading toward more toward composition and interpretation of other composers' musics. His latest album is The Big Gun Down, featuring music of Ennio Morricone. And he has a forthcoming album featuring a tribute to Mickey Spillane that will be called Hips Road, scheduled to be released in October. My name's Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next program, I'll speak with trumpeter Art Farmer, so I hope you can join us. Here's more music from John Zorn's tribute to Ennio Morricone. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Mm-hmm. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, Pulitzer Prize-winning composer John Harbison talks about his music, including compositions he's written for his wife, violinist Rosemary Harbison, who will also join us. Also today, Francis Davis reviews the new album by composer and saxophonist Ornette Coleman. It features Coleman's current group, Prime Time, as well as Coleman's original quartet. And television critic David Bianculli reviews Cinemax's original Max Talking Headroom show. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. Our jazz critic Francis Davis has a review of In All Languages, the latest album by composer and saxophonist Ornette Coleman. The album links Coleman's past with his present. It features Coleman's original quartet, recorded for the first time in over 25 years, and his current ensemble, Prime Time.
In All Languages, Ornette Coleman's new double album on the Caravan of Dreams label, is one of the year's most significant releases. The first two sides reunite the innovative alto saxophonist with trumpeter Don Cherry, bassist Charlie Hayden, and drummer Billy Higgins. This is the band that Coleman debuted, amid much controversy, at the Five Spot Cafe in Greenwich Village in 1959. The other two sides feature Prime Time, the electrified, funk-influenced rhythm and dissonance band that Coleman has led since the mid-70s. The album includes two versions of the title composition, In All Languages. One is by Prime Time. The other, which we'll hear, is by the quartet. It's a dirge like many others Coleman has written and performed over the years. The bass and drums enter at conflicting tempos at different places in the measure. That is to say, in unison, but in multiple keys, with each instrument in its own concert pitch, in gleeful defiance of the laws of just temperament. You'll hear what I mean. Coleman's solo is among the most inspired he's recorded. In one sense, it's little more than a series of thematic variations, beginning and ending with the same graceful ascending phrase. But with his speech-like cadences and inflections, and his logical yet unpredictable rush of ideas, Coleman almost makes you forget that he's playing an instrument. He could be thinking out loud. The title track from Ornette Coleman's new album, In All Languages, performed by his quartet. The two sides with the original quartet are so wonderful that the sides by Prime Time, which feature some of the same numbers, suffer by comparison, but only slightly. Prime Time's rhythms are less fluid, but they're harder and crunchier, and finally, no less ingratiating. The album was produced by Ornette Coleman's son, Donardo, who is also one of the drummers in Prime Time. For the quartet tracks, all Donardo really needed to do was roll the tapes. But he added too much echo to the horns, and one track suffers from studio chicanery. I'd also complain about the brevity of the performances, none of which is longer than 4 minutes. But the music itself is soul-stirring.
Jazz critic Francis Davis is the author of In the Moment, Jazz in the 1980s. He also writes for The Atlantic and the Philadelphia Inquirer. He reviewed Ornette Coleman's new album, In All Languages. You're listening to Fresh Air. My guests are composer John Harbison and violinist Rosemary Harbison. John Harbison is the winner of many awards and commissions, including this year's Pulitzer Prize for Music. Harbison is a jazz pianist as well as a classical violist. He's a professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and serves as the music director for the Los Angeles Philharmonic New Music Group. He's been a resident composer for the Los Angeles Philharmonic and the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra. Harbison has composed in nearly every form. He writes chamber music, symphonies, concertos, operas, and song cycles. You can get a sense of his range from his new album, which includes 2 pieces. One piece is called Variations and was written for violin, clarinet, and piano. The violinist on Variations is John Harbison's wife, Rosemary, who he often composes for. The other piece is called Mirabai Songs. It's based on Robert Bly's translation of 6 poems written in the 16th century by an Indian woman named Mirabai. When her husband died, she took to the streets singing and dancing to her soulful poems. Let's listen to the piece Don't Go, Don't Go from John Harbison's Mirabai Songs, sung by mezzo-soprano Janice Felty.
Thank you.
asked John Harbison what attracted him to the Mirabai poems.
It's, to me, a very powerful personality that comes through those poems, a woman of tremendous independence. And I thought of that cycle as not just a setting of poems, but as a kind of a evocation or characterization of this dancing singer from the 16th century India who speaks in a very contemporary language through Robert Bly.
You went to music school, to college, and then graduate school in the late 50s and early 60s. What were the ideas, the musical ideas then, that most excited you?
Well, the ones that most excited me, I must admit, in the 50s, probably were as much connected to the worlds of popular music and jazz as they were to so-called serious music or concert music.
Why did you end up composing new music instead of staying with popular music or jazz?
I think because I found that my deepest urges seemed to be towards very large kinds of structures, that is, putting together pieces which hung together or which made sense over a very long time span, like anywhere from 15 minutes to half an hour. And I didn't find in the classical, in the popular or jazz field, opportunities to do that sort of thing. I wasn't able to express what I felt was a certain kind of gift that I had.
You know, sometimes audiences catch up to new music, and in 30 years, things that seem very avant-garde or inaccessible become quite popular. And other times, the music just always stays ahead of the audience and remains in the avant-garde. I guess what I'm asking is, do you think your music will always remain art music?
Well, I think it's hard to predict whether art music will, as you said, whether any art music remains art music is very unpredictable. I think that what I'm hoping for is that my music continue as it seems to now to cut rather widely across audience divisions and to be somewhat unpredictable as to who's going to like it and where it's going to be played. And I think if it continues to do that, I'll be very happy.
You're a pianist. Can you perform your own music, or is it too difficult?
In all honesty, I'd say that 98% of it's too difficult.
Is it frustrating to write things that you can't perform?
Well, I guess it is only locally. In those moments when I sit down to practice it, I think, my God, how does anyone play this stuff? You know? But then I've heard from performers, accounts of my music seeming quite readily accessible at first and playable and getting harder as one works on it. And now to have experienced that myself with my own music, I'm perhaps more understanding about their dilemmas.
You write a lot of music for your wife, the violinist Rosemary Harbison, and I'd like to bring her into this conversation. First, let's hear some music that you wrote for her, and I want to play some of the variations featured on your latest album. Can you tell us what you had in mind about her sound or her capabilities as a performer when you wrote the violin part for her?
Yes, I wrote this piece for a trio of players who were all close musical associates of mine, Rosemary and David Satz, the clarinetist, and Ursel Oppens, the pianist. And I depended on these particular performers to be able to hear this piece as a whole and to make it cohere. And then, of course, I knew their individual playing very well. And in starting the piece off and in fact shaping the piece, I had a kind of leader-follower relationship between the clarinet and the violin, which switches roles. One leading, one following at different points.
Rosemary, when you're about to learn one of the pieces that John has written for you, do you talk about it with him, or do you not want him involved with that? Do you want to just be with the score and approach it without his discussion of it first?
I try to do as much as I can independently because I want to explore as much as I can what's there so that he hears, in a sense, what I naturally go for in the piece. Part of this is to give him an idea of whether what he writes things down, whether he's going to get a reading that's realistic that he wants back. I'm kind of the test pilot, so to speak, for these highfalutin pieces he rolls out.
John, do you have to take a piece over to Rosemary and say, is this playable?
I sometimes do that, but I also do depend on her to get a sense of what a player will do confronted with a certain thing on the page.
Mm-hmm. Rosemary, there is a phenomenon in our society where sometimes if a man and woman do something together, the man is taken more seriously than the woman is. And I wonder if you ever have to overcome this feeling of that some people might have, oh, well, she's the featured violinist because her husband wrote the piece. People who don't know your work and don't know what an accomplished performer you are, does that ever happen?
Well, it's certainly a torment for me, but it's that goes to a deeper issue than whether it's what the realities are. You can't both be going at life full tilt, I don't think. And so my view has been that John's life comes first, and I know this is going to get a lot of people's upset. But it comes first not because he is dominant, but because I think it works easier in the relationship for that to be the case. In a funny way, my being able to stay in the background has turned me into the artist I really wanted to become because I've been able to be more speculative. There's something to be said for being able to sort of stand aside and take in what's really going on. It's very, very useful at times, and I think I've used it to great advantage. I'm real happy with where I'm at right now as an artist, and it's been a long time coming.
Do you ever play together just for pleasure at home? And if so, what kind of music do you play?
No, we certainly do. We play, I'd say when we're just playing for ourselves, we play most often Bach sonatas.
Mm-hmm.
And we play jazz. Sometimes we play bass line for each other as jazz players. And lately we've been playing violin piano jazz or pop songs. And we sometimes play four-hand piano, though that tends to be the most difficult. For some reason, it touches nerves.
It's because I never know the changes.
Well, I meant also we play Schubert four-hand piano, and the question is Rosemary is a far better pianist than I am. As pianist, but I'm a better reader. And so we have great conflict about who should play the first part and so forth.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
It's great to talk to you. Thanks.
Thank you.
Composer John Harbison and violinist Rosemary Harbison spoke to us from radio station WHA in Madison, Wisconsin. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What's up for today's program?
Today, the UN is voting on a resolution for a ceasefire in the Persian Gulf. We'll have a report from Kuwait on what that might mean for American efforts to reflag Kuwaiti ships. Also, in South Korea, political prisoners are being released, and we have a story on who's being let out of jail and what they went through while they were being held. And a South Korean dissident is returning home after years of living in the U.S. We speak to him about his situation and that of several dozens of South Koreans who hope to participate in building a democracy back in South Korea. And finally, we visit a drive-in movie in Baltimore with one of the greatest fans of drive-ins, filmmaker John Waters.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Starting this week, the TV character Max Headroom is back in yet another incarnation, this time on cable TV. Critic David Bianculli gives us the history of Max Headroom and some thoughts about the new show.
I'm worried about Max Headroom. When he crept onto the TV scene in 1985, I was an immediate fan. Now, 2 years later, I wonder if Max Headroom is in danger of becoming the next Joan Rivers. The question is, will success spoil Max Headroom? Let's go back to the beginning. The character of Max Headroom was created by the British division of Chrysalis Records to help promote the videos of new record artists. Someone decided that the best possible host for new wave videos was a new wave, seemingly computerized talking head. Then they dreamed up a British TV movie to launch it. The Max Headroom story was set 20 minutes into the future, and its hero was TV reporter Edison Carter, the biggest star of Network 23, a giant and ruthless TV operation. Hot on the story of murder and corruption within his own network, Carter is nearly killed, but not before a young computer wizard transfers Carter's memory and image into a computer bank. The plan is to have a computer-generated image of Edison Carter take the real Carter's place on Network 23, but three things go wrong. First, Carter doesn't die. Second, the fake Carter stutters and stammers. Third, the fake Carter quickly develops a mind and personality of its own. He looks kind of like Carter, but he's his own non-man. He's Max Headroom, wisecracking computer creation. The movie ends with Carter disappearing into the sunset, but Max stays around and gets a new series and starts interviewing rock stars such as Sting and Boy George. He shows videos, too, but he treats them just as he does his guests, making fun of them and often interrupting them. In this country, Cinemax imported both the Max Headroom story and its interview format sequel, The Max Headroom Show. Max caught on so quickly that Cinemax threw the character into its own rock video series, while Coca-Cola hired Max as its new spokesman. Then Cinemax imported a new Max Headroom talk show, done before a live audience. Having the audience there made a big difference. The new show was awful. After that came the ABC series this past spring, which started out with an Americanized version of the original movie. The difference is that it came up with a way to keep both Edison Carter and Max Headroom around, and stayed loyal to the original science fiction premise. ABC's Max Headroom is a mixture of Paddy Chayefsky's Network and Ridley Scott's Blade Runner. I love it, and I'm glad ABC renewed it for the fall. But now the bad news. Beginning this Thursday on Cinemax, Max Headroom is back in another talk show, taped in New York this time in front of a live audience. On the first show, Max interviews model Jerry Hall, who eagerly accepts his invitation to howl while Max sings an improvised country song. I'm glad this is radio, because I don't have to just describe it. You get to hear this for yourself. If you have a dog, cover its ears.
Jerry, babe, you are my heart's desire. You and me could set the world on fire.
There's nothing I can add to that. Matt Frewer, who plays both Max and Carter, should lighten his load and drop this Cinemax show as soon as he can. ABC's Max Headroom is great. Cinemax's original Max Talking Headroom show is guano.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a preview of tomorrow's program. On our next show, I'll speak with humorist Howard Moore. He was a writer for Garrison Keillor's Prairie Home Companion, best known for Raw Bits and Minnesota Language Systems. Also, rock historian Ed Ward will profile the group Love, one of the wilder of the San Francisco groups playing in the summer of 1967. And book critic John Leonard will review Songlines, Bruce Chatwin's work on Australia. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Today's show was produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Lisa Bruton. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Our engineer is Orji Voblaitis. Chris Bergen directs the show. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.